Hello and welcome back to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and today I'm joined by our reviews editor, Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
Hi. And our news editor, Jordan Farley.
Hello.
So this week we're talking to Steve McQueen about Small Axe and reviewing opening film Mangrove. Plus we're assessing Sophia Loren's return to the screen in The Life Ahead, new Christmas movie Jingle Jangle, and documentary Billy. But before we get onto those, there's some show about a bounty hunter and a child. What's that about, Jordan?
Don't know what you're talking about.
Dog the Bounty Hunter?
Dog the Bounty Hunter, yes. No, seriously, what's going on in The Mandalorian?
Yeah, The Mandalorian's back, season two. We're two episodes in now. And if you watch the first season, you'll know that it's a great show. I absolutely love The Mandalorian. And I've enjoyed the first two episodes of season two quite a bit, I'd say. The first season had this sort of odd structure where you had bookends of the season, which were kind of arc plotty and drove the story forward. And you had these kind of weird standalone adventures in the middle. And this season so far, we've just had like two kind of standalone story set in a galaxy far, far away. And I found it really fun. I like that it's kind of drawing more on its Western influences this year than it has done in the past. The first episode is set in this classic Western style town with a road running through the middle of it. And there's a marshal and a gunslinger, all this kind of stuff. I know we don't want to delve too much into spoilers just in case people are still catching up, but there's some big stuff for Star Wars fans in that first episode, especially as well.
Well, talking about big Star Wars fans, you know, our big office nerd is Matthew Leyland. How's it working out for you? Is this pure pleasure for you, Matthew?
Yes, I've been waiting all year for this because it's a whole year since we've had any. Well,
no.
I guess the first season came out earlier this year, but that was delayed from the US. So, yeah, it's been a long time since we've had any new Star Wars content. So, yeah, I'm absolutely reveling in it. I'm quite sad that it's already a quarter over, that we've only got six more episodes to go. Although they have announced they're making season three already, and there's rumours of spin-offs. So that'll keep me going for a while. But, yes, I'm loving it. Can't wait for the next one.
Without any spoilers, is there anything so far that's really, really sort of got you excited?
Yeah, as Jordan mentioned, the end of episode one, there's a massive, biggest Easter egg imaginable.
That's Easter egg.
We've been waiting decades for.
Yeah, we can't mention because some people, Jamie Graham we're talking about, are saving up these episodes to binge watch them in one go because he can't bear to wait a week between episodes. So yes, let's be mindful of that. There are people like that.
I'm actually quite enjoying the weekly wait. I tend to, like Jamie, watch most things in a binge nowadays, but I'm enjoying just parceling this out and kind of savoring each episode as they come.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, it really lets you kind of wallow in these worlds that they're building because the really fun thing about Mandalorian is that it kind of takes its time. You know, the films are, especially the sequel trilogy, they were pretty relentless. They were pretty full throttle. And, you know, it's always like end of the universe stakes and it doesn't get any bigger. But with this, it just feels like you really get to luxuriate in parts of the galaxy that we haven't seen before, which is it's really nice.
It's like a taster menu. You want that space between the courses to really enjoy each flavor and the palate cleanse.
And the more time we get to spend with Baby Yoda, the better.
I mean you can't have enough Baby Yoda, can you?
You really can't.
No. I think the effects are even better this season. They look like they've stepped it up a bit. He's a bit more expressive and his movements are just a bit more natural. I mean, it was great in the first season, but it looks like they've really taken it to the next level.
I don't know if they've updated the puppet or if it's just the VFX work that's improved. But it looks like they have spent quite a bit more on this season compared to the first. Especially in the first episode, which has this kind of huge encounter with a creature that we won't mention, just in case you haven't seen it. But that was proper big screen blockbuster stuff.
Absolutely.
Especially with the fact that I don't know if they actually shot it on IMAX cameras, but you get this sort of aspect ratio shift. So the action fills the whole screen instead of, you know, you get the usually it's shot in 2.35, so you get the black bars at the top and the bottom. But for this, it goes full screen and it's just like, oh, it's incredible. Yeah, it's cool. Really well done.
Okay, so before you cry tears of joy, shall we move on to talk about some... I know. I honestly feel like Jordan's on the brink there of weeping. Shall we talk about something else that's happening this week is our new issue arrives on Friday with Mank on the cover. And now the embargoes have dropped, so we can just say quickly, is it everything that people are saying? I mean, it's five stars across the board. People are saying this is like gong worthy. It's going to sweep the awards. Is it a film that's going to get Fincher an Oscar finally? What do you think?
the Academy voters love a film about Hollywood, golden age Hollywood, especially. Mm. So I think it's got a decent shot of getting enough attention to get significant awards traction. But other than that, it's a fantastic film, like really fantastic. Slight spoilers for our next issue, but it's getting 5 stars from us as well. Yeah. And for good reason, like it fully deserves that 5 stars. It's a really, really impressive piece of work. Probably Fincher's best film since The Social Network. Really lovingly made, ooh, script written by his own father. Feels like a clear passion project for him. Yeah, I loved every second of it.
Feels like a labor of love, doesn't it? And it's just beautiful to look at. Filmed in all the ways that the 1930s did stuff. So that rear projection when they're in cars and the sound is all sort of weird and sort of, and people talking very, very 1930s. It's just a treat, isn't it? So if you want to find out more about that film and the process, we talked long, long, long hours with Fincher and his cast in the new issue. And it is available on newsstands on Friday. Subscribers, you'll already have it. I hope you're enjoying your Fincher designed cover that he created for us. But yeah, get it on Friday. Shall we move on then to what we can look at this week, actually, on our cinema screens at home? Because sadly, still not in cinema screens out in the public. So let's kick off with this.
On Sunday, the 9th of August in North Kensington, a demonstration took place against the police, which degenerated into totally inexcusable violence. There may be some who believe that they have been the victim of injustice at the hands of the police. Others who, like parasites, feed on these beliefs and seek to turn them to their own advantage, deliberately creating hate and violence. These defendants are all guilty of a serious criminal offence.
Okay, so that's Mangrove, which is the first film in the Small Axe series by Steve McQueen. Matthew, do you want to tell us what this is about?
Yeah, so this is Mangrove. This is the first film in Steve McQueen's Small Axe anthology. We've had the trial of the Chicago 7. This is the trial of the Mangrove 9. So it's set in early 70s, and it centres on a Notting Hill restaurant called the Mangrove, which is owned by Frank Critchlow, who's played by Sean Parks. It's a thriving restaurant. It's a centre for the black community, but it's subject to these police raids, these constant harassment from police. So Frank and the local community, including the British chapter of the Black Panthers, organise a peaceful protest, but then they're charged and arrested with incitement to riot. That's all in the first half of the film. Then the second half of the film concentrates on the trial of the Mangrove Nine at the Old Bailey. It's a two-parter, really, and it's mostly a courtroom drama.
We'll get into this a bit more. Yeah. But before we talk about the film, let's hear what McQueen had to say about the work when he sat down with our Hollywood correspondent, Adam Tanswell. And Adam started out by asking him how the project had come about.
The process started about 11 years ago when I had this conversation with the BBC. And as with all journeys, things change, especially over that length in time. It ended up with that I thought these should be movies, feature films. The reason being because I had one idea of one family going through this narrative from 68 to 84. But then what happened was that I realized there were so many interesting individual stories that I wanted to tell. And I thought to myself, okay, what I need to do is to make these feature films. At first, I did have a writer's room. What that writer's room turned out to be, it turned out to be an auditioning situation for the two writers I wanted to work with, which were Alistair Sims and Courtney Newland. From then on, things sort of took shape.
What point did this collection of stories come together, and why were these stories chosen in particular? Are there others still in the back of your mind that you may come back to at a future date?
There's so many stories to choose from. I wanted to definitely start with Mangrove. That was the thing I really wanted to start with. Absolutely. Then it was two other stories, which were personal to me. Lover's Rock, which was a story of my aunt sort of going out into these blues parties. And then the other one was the education that happened outside of the writer's room. Because in some ways, it was about my own narrative. And in a way, I was a bit scared, to be honest with you, to face up to certain things within that narrative. But I knew I had to go there. And then the other two, Alex Wheatle was in the writer's room. And he was such an amazing guy. And his story was his story, because we said to everyone, let's empty our handbags on the table. And his story was so amazing that at first, you know, it wasn't talked about. But after a while, I thought, we've got to tell your story. And then the last one, of course, is Red, White and Blue, which was about sort of, you know, how this man, this black man, Leroy Logan, sort of, you know, assimilates into the police in order to change it. Because it needed a situation where I was dealing with an institution. So that one came also as well from conversations with myself and Courtney Newland.
And talking of the Leroy Logan story, at what point did you get to speak to the man himself?
We met up quite early on in our research. I mean, I was scratching my head when I was speaking to him. I know that Courtier was too. I mean, you know, how does a black man join the police force after an incident with his father took place, and especially in the early 80s? And therefore, I couldn't work it out. But what was attractive to me that drew me closer in was his relationship with his father and that sort of story of friction. That story kind of paralleled my life, and it paralleled Courtier's life, and it also paralleled John Baker's life on sort of quite strong fathers who had quite strong opinions on what their son should do.
Talking of parallels as well, you've spoken out about the sort of parallel between John Boyega's life in Star Wars and Leroy Logan's in the police force of being the sort of poster boy. At what point did you realise that parallel was happening as well?
Well, I think you don't go out to make those parallels when you're making a picture. Things just happen. Like when we started making Red, White and Blue, you know, it was really strange how art intertwines with real life. I mean, for example, when we were making that movie, John, I know that, you know, our conversations in that movie sort of had an influence on him. And then, you know, he went to Hyde Park and had that speech. But also after that speech, he came back and did about 5 days of shooting in the movie. So there's important scenes in there. So he influenced the movie, and we influenced him in the way of who he was at that time. So in a way, it was, you know, art and life. Sometimes there's a situation where there's a fusion. And again, he was the poster boy. Leroy Logan was the poster boy of the Metropolitan Police. And so, of course, was John Boyega, as far as being in one of the biggest franchises in the world, Star Wars. Both were seen as sort of rising stars. And what happens is that they don't get to rise as high as they thought they would because of the industry they're in. So there's a huge parallel there.
Can you also talk about filming in the midst of a pandemic?
We did 10-day shoot. It was 5 days with John and other feature films. That was really well done because, you know, we obviously followed the government guidelines, but also it was just really how careful we were and considerate we were, and social distancing and so forth and whatnot. It was great. It was, you know, it's the best of British. What can I tell you?
That's Steve McQueen talking about Mangrove. What did you guys make of this? I mean, this is a tough watch, isn't it? It's unflinching in its portrayal of police brutality, police racism, sort of social fracturing, the way that the system is stacked against black people in the 60s, and does a lot in drawing that into parallels with today. Did you enjoy it? Is it something you can enjoy when you watch it?
Yeah, I think so, just because, I mean, he's such a dynamic filmmaker. I mean, it's kind of, I suppose, restricted in a way by the courtroom setting, but he always finds really interesting angles. I mean, he makes amazing use of close-ups and long speeches. He's fantastic with actors always, Steve McQueen. Yeah, like you say, it's a tough watch, but it's very dynamic as well and gripping, and the script is so precise and the actors are so precise with it as well. It's pretty enthralling.
Jordan?
Yeah, I have to admit, I mean, to my shame, I really knew nothing about this case going in. So it was incredibly, you know, eye-opening and shockingly relevant in some ways, in much the same way that, you know, Matthew mentioned earlier, Aaron Sorkin's film, The Trial of the Chicago Seven, the way that had remarkable kind of parallels with what's going on today. This is exactly the same. You know, there's a moment in this film where the judge, he makes a statement where he declares there's been racial hatred on both sides, and just to hear that phrase that, you know, both sides said in, you know, British court of law, given the connotations that you associate with it nowadays, it made me feel like a little bit sick. It was quite horrifying to watch, and, you know, that's all quite deliberate, and it's really effective in that way in making you focus on the racial injustices that were there in the late 60s and early 70s that are still very relevant and prevalent today.
Yeah. Let's talk about the actors. I mean, the cast here is just fantastic and amazing. I mean, all of them are so great. Who stood out for you?
Yeah, I think it's Sean Parks, really. I mean, I remember Sean Parks from Human Traffic. I think that was the first time I encountered him.
And very different role.
Yeah.
The Mummy, where he plays the pilot, the one-eyed pilot.
I'd forgotten he was in that. Yeah.
That was my first experience of him.
Yeah, so we know how well he can do comedy, but this is obviously a very serious role. You can really feel the kind of despair and anger that he's going through, all this injustice that he's suffering. And there's fantastic just single long shots of him. There's a great shot of him in a cell at one point. I mean, just the fury just explodes off the screen. So, yeah, I thought he was terrific. And Letitia Wright as well.
She's great, isn't she?
Yeah, she's been in Black Panther, the movie, but this is playing an actual real-life Black Panther. She's so fantastic, and especially in the courtroom scenes as well, when she's taking down the prosecution, you know, arguing so eloquently against them and so focused. Mm. Yeah, she's just absolutely fantastic.
I really like that stuff, because one of the points of the story is that a couple of the defendants choose to represent themselves. So you get Letitia and Malachi Kirby actually cross-examining these police officers who have accused them of these crimes. And it just feels like so powerful and effective to have them addressing these police officers directly rather than, it going through a barrister. That I found really moving and really impactful. But Letitia Wright is phenomenal in this film, I thought. And I really thought it was a compelling collection of characters, because it's not like they're all united in one cause. Because Frank himself, he owns the mangrove, but he didn't open the mangrove as this hub of activism. He opens it because he is a business, it's a restaurant for him. He didn't want to be a hub for social change. It's not like that for him. So you have these differing ideals and these differing motivations about what's going on in this podcast.
We've got the whole spectrum of sort of political interest in this, haven't you?
Exactly.
But that everybody is being affected in the same way by the system. Yeah. And then I also liked, the fact that we also see this unflinching look at the police officers involved as well. I mean, Sam Spruill is hideous in this, isn't he?
Yeah, he really is.
It's so horrible to watch and so believable. You can well believe the sort of chats that the police officers have together whilst they're having their cups of tea and playing cards. It's really tough to watch.
Yeah, just totally rooted in racism and bigotry. Like, there's no honest reason for the police to be doing what they're doing in this film. It's all just based on lies and hatred. And it's weird to see police officers in those uniforms as well. Like, I don't know, it's horrible. It was like, it almost looks like a uniform of hatred nowadays when you associate it with what they're doing in this film. But then you also have the fact that they look faintly comical as well. Like, it kind of reminded me a bit of the end of Monty Python and the Holy Grail, where the police just come storming in.
It's almost farcical, isn't it? The amount of times that they raid the mangrove and their sort of actions in doing
furious.
Tumbling through the door and just a completely ridiculous level of violence to people.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed the cook as well at the mangrove, who was always dancing and always had a toothpick in her mouth and was just singing songs. She was really great. And I love the music in this. I think the music.
It's a great soundtrack.
It's so fantastic. Really evocative. Yes. You get a sense of the era and the community in Notting Hill. I think it's really, really great.
It's really interesting for this film to be coming so soon after Chicago 7 as well, because there are very clear points of comparison to make with the two of them. Because in some ways, the judicial systems are so similar, and the way that the story's been structured is very sort of similar as well. And just what the trials represented for those communities, there are very clear points of comparison, even though, they're set on different sides of the Atlantic.
Yeah.
And what it meant for, the police and the legal systems in the respective countries. It just felt dirty and grounded and authentic in a way that the Chicago 7, as much as I love that film, that felt more showy and a little bit more like kind of light entertainment. Whereas this felt like you were really, you kind of feel like you have dirt under your nails by the time you finish watching the film. It's like you've really kind of been through something with these characters.
Yeah, and you really feel educated at the end of this film and wanting to learn more. I mean, I want to go off and find out about Paul Bogle, for example. His picture is on the wall of the mangrove. I wanted to find out more about him. And he was, this Jamaican hero who was part of a rebellion there. And there's all these little layers that McQueen puts in there that are sort of like, take this and learn from it, but also explore more, find out more, educate yourself. And I think that's really sort of invigorating in a film.
But it doesn't feel like a history lesson. It doesn't feel like you know, you're being lectured at or anything like that. I mean, it feels so rooted in realism and naturalism.
So are we looking forward to the rest of this series of films?
Oh, yeah.
Obviously got John Boyega coming up in one of them. How many are there in this?
There are five in total.
There's five. Yeah. What a treat.
Airing once a week on the BBC over here and Amazon Prime in America.
So, I mean, what a treat to have Steve McQueen films that often every week. Yeah. Mangrove premieres on the BBC here on Sunday. Okay, let's move on. Shall we travel to Italy for this?
Madame Rosa ha iniziato a tenere i bambini degli altri puttani.
Ciao. Rosa, ho bisogno di un favore. Mamma l'ho presa in affitto subito dopo la tragedia. Io non ce la faccio più, sono vecchio.
Due mesi, non un giorno di più.
So that's The Life Ahead, which is by Eduardo Ponti, the son of Sophia Loren, and starring his mum as Madame Rosa, an ex-prostitute in the town of Bari in Puglia, who now looks after streetwalkers' children who cannot look after their children because their work prevents them from doing so. She is a Holocaust survivor, and she ends up taking in a young Senegalese orphan called Momo, who is troubled. It doesn't want to comply, doesn't want to behave himself, is a thief, is a drug dealer, and the two of them clash. But during one summer in Bari, with these beautiful little cobbled streets and the gorgeous lighthouse, they do find a way to understand each other. I loved this film. Matthew, did you?
I didn't love it, but I liked it a lot. I mean, it's terrific. I mean, we haven't seen Sophia Loren in a big role since Nine, the Daniel Day-Lewis musical.
Which wasn't that great anyway.
No, it was a bit of a disappointment, wasn't it? And she didn't have a very big role. But yeah, it's great to see her in her mid-80s, still a huge star, still emitting all that wattage at the centre of this film. And she gives a really kind of grounded, funny, quite tragic performance. I mean, it's kind of an all-rounder. I can well see her being nominated for this.
Absolutely. I think she has to be
nailed on.
She's absolutely incredible in this. She's magnetic on film, and just her character, Madame Rosa, is this sort of no-nonsense, incredibly warm, but, you know, tells you like it is character.
Yeah.
And just the relationship between her and the boy who plays Momo, Ibrahima Gaye, is so delightful. I mean, this is a child performance that is so truthful, so unstilted, unstiff.
It feels,
for want of a better word, organic, the performance that he gives. I could just watch them all day. I loved it. But also just, again, it feels like something that's very pertinent. This kid is Senegalese. He sort of doesn't expect anyone to give him a chance because of racism and social difficulties. And here's this woman who has suffered the worst, one of the worst things in our history, who has the time for him and has the tough love for him. And I found it incredibly moving. But also, you know, I just love the fact that, you know, this is a story about a woman mothering a boy that's filmed by the boy who was mothered by the actress. So it's like, you know, Eduardo Ponti is filming his own mother doing this sort of mothering. And there's just all these sort of layers of loveliness to that. And
Makes it more resonant.
Yeah, it really does. I loved it. And also I really enjoyed, I don't know about you, you know, obviously traveling to Bari in Puglia and, you know, seeing the markets and the cobbled streets and the sea and, you know, people having coffees outside and all of that sort of stuff. It was a bit of a transportation just to see that.
It kind of reminded me of our Moldovar film.
It did.
Especially in the kind of the lighter moments and the kind of inclusive vibe, the fact that it's very, very warm but not feeling too forced as well.
Yeah, it's warm, but it isn't cloying and it isn't saccharine. It's just very hopeful, isn't it, for a film that ostensibly could be quite bleak.
Yeah, because it doesn't kind of shy away from all that. I mean, the reality of being a drugs mule and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, at the same time, it does have this very kind of warm, upbeat feel to it. Her past history as well, which I thought was dealt with in quite sort of subtle, telling ways. They didn't nail it on the head too hard, but you really, really got the message from it.
Yeah, and I also loved, you know, there's this guy who also sort of befriends Momo, Mr. Hamill, who is this man who, you know, is very educated but runs this sort of lighter shop where he sells lighters and tobacco and things. But he really sort of puts up with a lot of crap from this kid as well and is lovely and warm. And then there's Lola, the prostitute who lives downstairs, and Madame Rosa looks after her child. And she's incredibly warm as well, and understands that life has been hard and can be hard for everybody, no matter who they are. It really does make you feel good about humankind.
And there's a couple of CGI interludes as well, which I wasn't expecting, but I thought they were well executed, the way they slotted that into the story. Kind of, it didn't feel gratuitous. It felt like it had a proper meaning, and that worked quite nicely. I wasn't expecting that CGI in this type of movie.
No, a CGI creature does pop up, but it totally works. I can't recommend this highly enough. What about you? Would you recommend that this is weekend viewing for people?
Yeah, especially if you like Sophia.
Who doesn't?
Who doesn't?
Who doesn't? Okay, so that is The Life Ahead, and that hits Netflix this Friday. Okay, so are we ready for our next film? Ready to get Christmassy?
Once upon a time, lived the greatest inventor that ever there was, Jeronicus Jangle.
Merry Christmas!
Merry Christmas indeed!
Jangle, for the last 30 years, you've been promising something sensational.
I need more time.
Either come up with the money you've borrowed by Christmas, or show me the revolutionary invention you once promised.
I would lose everything.
Okay, so this is Jingle Jangle, which is so Christmassy, it makes my teeth hurt. Jordan, what's it about?
It is like sucking on a sugar cane for like 2 hours straight, isn't it, basically? This is from writer-director David E. Talbot, who actually seems to have a thing for Christmas. His last two films, Almost Christmas and El Camino Christmas, were also, believe it or not, about Christmas.
He's rivaling Shane Black, isn't he?
Yeah, he's Mr. Christmas, basically. So it stars Forrest Whitaker as Jeronicus Jangle, the owner of Jangles and Things Toy Shop and the world's greatest inventor of children's toys. In a flashback at the start of the film, we learn that just as Jeronicus has made a breakthrough on his greatest invention to date, this sentient kind of small Spanish man played by Ricky Martin, of all people, his book of inventions is stolen by his apprentice Gustafsson, later played by Keegle, Mike and Key. Cut to many years later, Gustafsson has profited off all of Jeronicus's ideas to become the richest sort of toy maker in the world, while Jeronicus basically wallows in his shop and has lost his mojo entirely. That is until his granddaughter, Journey, played by Madeline Mills, visits him in Cobbleston, the town that he lives in, and essentially reawakens his imagination. So it's sort of classic Christmas territory, literally a festive fairy tale, in fact, as there's this framing device where what we're seeing is a story that's being read to these two young children and to us as viewers. And Talbot is clearly having an absolute ball in this world that he's built. There are some really gorgeous sort of sets here filled with these, you know, wonderful mechanical contraptions. And it's a musical, we should point out, with songs co-written.
I mean, everything, the whole shebang. Thrown everything at the Christmas tree here.
It really is. The songs are actually co-written by John Legend. So, you know, the film erupts into song and dance every so often in a way that reminded me a bit of The Greatest Showman. It sort of tunes in that sort of register. And even though it's a fairly low-stakes story, I'd say, you're sort of never in any doubt about how things are going to play out. I found this like really heartfelt and vibrant and fun. Possibly a little overstuffed, like you say, it really just sort of throw everything at the screen. It's like a Christmas tree that's basically about to tumble over because it's got so many sort of decorations piled onto every branch. But I thought this was pretty entertaining and very sweet.
Did you like it, Matthew?
I did, yeah, I felt similar. I mean, the story really feels like a sort of cut price Hugo in a way.
With the mechanical kind of stuff,
and the kind of inventor down on his luck. You could kind of see all the twists coming, but it's decorated so beautifully that it doesn't really matter. I mean, the costumes are fabulous. Forrest Whitaker has this amazing dressing gown, which is straight to the top of my Christmas list. I thought the effects were really, really good. All the animated characters, I thought they really came to life well. The songs earwormed me. I've still got one playing in my head from when I saw it. Yeah, and it's so Christmassy. I mean, it really gets you in the mood for the festive season. And I think that will just grow as we get nearer to the big day as well.
Ordinarily, I don't enjoy a Christmas movie unless it's Bad Santa and it's filthy and dirty. but I think this year, probably, we're all desperate for a bit of Christmas cheer, aren't we? Yeah. This is the sort of film that you're going to, you know, give the benefit of the doubt more than you might have done any other year.
Yeah, definitely. Totally. And it has clearly been made with a lot of affection and actually some quite impressive craft. Like we were saying, the sets are genuinely quite awe-inspiring, some of them. As Matthew mentioned, it has these animated sort of interludes, which are told in this sort of storybook fashion, which I thought were really beautiful, really, really well done. So it's a film that, you know, it's not like you're compromising with this film. It's not like you're going, oh, I'll put up with it just because it's Christmas themed. There's some really impressive work going on in here.
Yeah. It kind of feels like what the Nutcracker was aiming for a couple of years ago, the Nutcracker and the Four Realms with Keira Knightley. But I mean, that just came across as kind of eerie and spooky and hollow, whereas this, you know, really kind of glows with the festive spirit.
Yeah, I mean, it's full of heart, which my coal black little heart might slightly warm to.
You can't help but sort of smile at some of the stuff that's in here. There's a sort of snowball fight in the middle of it. And I was like rolling my eyes going, oh no, not the snowball fight scene. But then it's just done in such a sweet, silly way. I just couldn't help but smile all the way through it. It really won me over.
Obviously, kids are going to love it. It's not a tiresome film for adults to watch. And for people who love Christmas, it's Christmas come early, I think we can probably say.
Yeah, I can imagine this being on repeat in a lot of households.
It will be on repeat in Matt Matum's house because he loves Christmas. Obviously, he has the very strict rule about when it can start.
When does he say it can start? Yeah.
I think ordinarily he would say you can't start doing Christmassy stuff until the 1st of December. But I think he may have relaxed that rule purely because of the horror of 2020. He's probably already listening to his John Legend Christmas album right now on his holiday.
As far as I'm concerned, Christmas is now. Let's get it going. Like, what are we waiting for this year?
Why not? Nothing else to do.
So I think it makes sense that Netflix are releasing this, you know, in the middle of November.
Indeed. Indeed. Okay, so if you fancy a bit of Christmas in your life, and who doesn't, then it is out on Netflix this Friday. You can fill your heart's content with tinsel, snowballs, baubles, the whole shebang. It is coming at you. Okay, shall we move on then? Now it's time for a little bit of jazz.
Must be a pretty interesting story. She's had a wild life.
No innovator was like her, nobody.
Beautiful soul that she could only express it by singing.
Encore and encore.
Without even trying, she was the great lady of all time.
Billy, why so many jazz greats seem to die so early?
The only way I can answer that question is we try to live 100 days in one day.
Okay, so this is Billy, which is about Billie Holiday, right, Jordan?
Yes, it is. It's James Erskine's documentary about, you know, the legendary jazz singer, activist Billie Holiday. And if you know two things about Billie Holiday, as well as being an incredible singer who sang incredibly provocative protest songs like Strange Fruit, you'll know she had a drug addiction, which troubled her throughout her life and career. Erskine's film, it's actually constructed from hundreds of interviews conducted by a journalist called Linda Kuhl, who was writing a biography about Billie after her death. And before Linda herself died under mysterious circumstances in 1979. So as well as a documentary about the life of Billie Holiday, you also have this framing story about this journalist who was writing a biography about Billie and then died herself. So it's almost like two stories in one in that sense.
It's like I'll Be Gone in the Dark, isn't it? In that sort of idea that this is as much about the person pursuing the story as the story.
Exactly. Yeah. But the bulk of the film, it has to be said, is Billie's story. And it's told, you know, from her upbringing in poverty through to her rise to fame, her time in prison, and her untimely death in 1959 at the age of just 44. Mm. And it's kind of a real warts and all depiction of her life. The people that Linda spoke to were very frank about Billy's life and the kind of struggles she went through. There are a lot of sort of very revealing anecdotes. Billie Holiday apparently had a very active sex drive, and you get a lot of quite frank stories about her taking a man home and then going out back to find a woman to sleep with,
and then finding a prostitute.
Yeah, it's some really wow. quite incredible stuff in here. It doesn't feel salacious though, it just feels like quite an honest depiction of who Billie Holiday was, who she quite proudly was. There's a very real and powerful depiction of, you know, what it was like to be Billie Holiday, rising to fame in, you know, 40s and 50s America, where racism was rampant. As I mentioned earlier, one of her most famous songs, Strange Fruit, which is a protest song about the lynching of black men, that she demanded to sing in every venue that she went to. And this effectively got her banned from more and more concert halls as her career went on. And it was one of the reasons why she was public enemy number one in the eyes of the police and the FBI, who really targeted her over the fact that she was also a drug addict and essentially frames her in sending her to jail for a year. So there's some really like powerful emotive stuff in here.
Yeah. And you know, like there's this whole idea of when she was touring the South, she had to darken her face because she wasn't dark enough for what was deemed somebody who sang in a jazz band. And if she was playing with a white band, the white band were in a hotel and she'd often have to sleep in the car or, you know, like stay up all night because she wouldn't be able to get accommodation. And just little things like, you know, having to buy two hamburgers when she got served because she didn't know if the next stop she'd actually be served. These sort of little details, and as you say, this sort of really encompassing idea of what she was like, that she was sort of voracious in every way. She took drugs, yes. She was unapologetically sexual, bisexual, potty mouthed, a freedom fighter. She smoked loads. She danced. She stayed up all night. And, you know, she says, you know, the reason jazz singers die so young is they try to live 100 days in one day. And you really get this sense of who she was and how mercurial and exciting and sensual she was. And that really informs the way she sings. And you really can understand more about her singing voice, which I've only ever heard, you know, a few songs by Billie Holiday. But I, at the end of this, wanted to go and buy an album because I think this documentary does a wonderful job of really giving all of the history that goes into that amazing voice.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the one shame about the documentary is, for obvious reason, Billie's voice is missing from it, other than her stage performances. You know, Linda, the journalist whose interviews are drawn from this film, never actually met or interviewed Billie Holiday. So you don't have the sort of first-hand account from Billie herself. And the fact that, you know, she was a singer who was performing in the 40s and 50s. There's very little footage of her outside of her, you know, stage performances. So a lot of it is constructed from still photography and just general archive footage. So it's not like a kind of Amy documentary where you just have this wealth of recorded material to draw on, where you really get a sense of what her life was like growing up. You kind of have to construct certain things in your head just from the interview accounts that you're receiving. And I'm not sure the kind of secondary story that you get in this film about Linda entirely worked for me in the way that it did. As you mentioned, I'll Be Gone in the Dark, like those two stories felt inextricably intertwined. But in this, it feels like an unnecessary addition in a way. It feels like you've got a sort of murder mystery plugged onto a documentary about one of the most influential and important jazz singers of the 20th century. It's an odd combination, and I sort of admire James Erskine for trying something different, but it didn't entirely gel for me, that aspect.
I agree with you. I don't think it was as sort of riveting and as interesting as I'll Be Gone in the Dark, that aspect of it. But I did enjoy knowing a little bit more about this woman, because on the tapes, you do hear her talking. Yeah. It's not just the responses of the people she's interviewing. And I thought she was a great interviewer. She's just really gentle and very quietly spoken. But she does ask questions in a way that really does elicit very interesting responses. So I was curious about her and her life and what sort of prompted her to do this. And also the fact that this had become a total obsession for her. She became involved in the people's lives that she was interviewing and really sort of obsessed with Billie Holiday. It's nice that she's getting that credit rather than just having her materials ripped off and put in a film and being a side note on the end credits.
Yeah, that is true. I guess my only criticism is, you know, this film is called Billie. It's not called Billie and Linda. Like, if you go into this film, you're expecting, you know, Billie's story, and you do get that, but you get this other thing as well, which was a slight distraction for me. But you're right, Linda is a fascinating figure in her own right. I think she was a school teacher who was basically just a Billie Holiday fan and had a sort of side career in journalism. Yeah, I'm kind of jealous at how good she is as an interviewer.
I was like, I am taking some of these tips, Linda. You are, you know, these crotchety old jazz trumpeteers and jazz leaders who are just melting under her questioning. Mm. It's quite the masterclass. So yeah, if you fancy listening to Linda and Billie, but mostly Billie, and finding out a bit more about her, Billie is available on demand from BFI, IFI, Curzon Home Cinema and Barbican from tomorrow, and you can buy it from the 16th of November. Okay, so that's all we've got for this week. We will see you next week. But before we go, shall we answer a reader's question? And I think Jordan's going to love this one. What movie pet would you like to have as your very good boy or girl? Jordan, you've obviously got a very good boy in Scoob, who already looks like a movie character. And in fact, you dressed him up as what for Halloween?
I dressed him up as Falcor, the luck dragon from The Neverending Story.
And he looks magnificent.
He is a blonde doggy with a resemblance to Falcor. So it had to be done.
But if you didn't have Scoob, what other movie pet would you enjoy?
I've got to make sure Scoob isn't in earshot so he doesn't hear me talking about
I'm getting
the dog.
Jealous.
But I'm going to pick an actual doggo, which is Hashiko from Hashi, A Dog's Tale, which might be the most upsetting film I've ever seen.
Why don't you just have Marley as well and be done with it?
Marley, yeah. I love Marley.
That film's pure cheese, though. Hashi, A Dog's Tale, that's the real stuff. That's
I can never watch it again.
Yeah, I know, same here, but he's a Japanese Akita, and he's just unflinchingly loyal to his master, which leads to probably the most devastating and heartbreaking film ending of all time.
I'm filling up.
I would just love to give Hashiko a cuddle, basically.
Okay. Matthew, come on, what are you having?
I'd go for Snowbell the cat from Stuart Little, the really grumpy, miserable but funny cat. I know, but he's funny though. I always preferred him. Nathan Lane. I mean, I love Michael J. Fox, but Nathan Lane is fantastic. I think he's great.
And you'd want to be able to hear his commentary as he wandered around your house.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I'm just not that keen on mice, so it'd have to be the cat. And he's a handsome cat as well, so aesthetically pleasing. Yeah, that'd be mine.
So I'd probably go for Gizmo, because I just think he's adorable, but I'd obviously be far more careful with him. He'd have a little house, Gizmo house. He'd be locked in it every night before midnight. No water, no snacking. I don't want those gremlins, but I would like him. I think he's delightful. Also, you know that little worm in the labyrinth that has like a Mohican and two like pigtails? Is that available as a pet? Because I think that would, it's small. You wouldn't have to take it for a walk, and it'd just be like, come on in, have a cup of tea. It could make you little tiny worm cups of tea, and you could just have a chat to it. I think that would be nice.
Yeah.
I like Samantha in I'm Legend. Samantha the dog.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Be a good companion when the apocalypse comes.
There are plenty of them out there, and nobody's gone for Lassie, so we're all good. Okay, so on that note, if you would like to read more about Mank and also all the other great content in this issue's magazine, it is out on sale on Friday in supermarkets and in newsagents, so you don't have to worry about going down the proper shops. You can go locally and find it. Please do. We'd appreciate it if you did, and let us know what you think of it. On that note, shall we say goodbye? Are you off to go and watch Jingle Jangle again just to keep your spirits up?
I might go and buy the soundtrack, I think.
Oh my God. Is this going to be our new office soundtrack, the Jingle Jangle
one?
Getting my earplugs ready. Okay.
It's the new Greatest Showman, I told you.
Yeah.
And that is just striking fear into me because, as you know, I did not love that film.
No, I was not a fan.
Okay, so on that note, we will sing our way out of here and we will see you next week. Same time, same place. Say bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Stand still, can't explain what I feel. If this is really real, nothing's ever gonna be the same.
get to say goodbye to the struggle in life. Say hello to the sky, spread my wings and fly away. Even though life's been knocking me down, I had to figure it out, see my way through the doubt. And when it seems I'm lost, turn and find.